I pay homage to the Buddha, the Gautama, who out of his compassion taught the holy Dharma to rid us of all negative, distorted views. So I will go through the text now. We are on Shaman Lamrim, I think His Holiness yesterday mentioned. Dara. So the topic is second, how to rely through action. So I guess this is second, develop and respect, and having relied on the Guru, how to train. So the second, having relied on him, the steps to train in the mind. It has two parts, inspiring to take the essence in the life of leisure and resources, and how to take essence in this life. The former has two subdivisions, the nature of cessation and the break in between the sessions. Regarding the first, there are three parts to it: preparation, the actual practice, and the conclusion. And the first, the preparation, is regarding this, a single point of supplication is the same as before. Then I will all my mother sentient beings are born in samsara and suffer. So with regard to four sangha members, which comes some way down below, there are two different ways of counting the four sangha members. And there is a commentary to the Sutra Samuchaya by Abhayakara. He counts the two upasakas, the lay persons with vows, the male and female, plus the bhikshus and bhikshuni. And so two members from the monastic sangha, the fully ordained monks and nuns, and then the two upasaka and upasaki. And so in Tibet, it is because we count the bhikshuni in this fourfold sangha, we should have the bhikshuni ordination as well. The Buddha himself gave the bhikshuni ordination. And then in Tibet, I think we had some discussion. In Tibet, we have the Mula Sarvastivada tradition. And So the fourfold sangha includes the bhikshuni. And so because in Tibet, the bhikshuni of the Sarvasvada tradition, Mula Sarvasvada tradition, couldn't come to Tibet, this could not happen, the bhikshuni ordination. And so there was a case that some master gave ordination of bhikshuni to one's mother, or so that maybe some... We also talk about a flawless ordination. And in China and in Vietnam, there is the Dharmagupta ordination lineage. So although they are different lineage from us, so with regard to this bhikshuni ordination, we have made some effort to convene international level meetings of Sangha. And so far it has not been very clear. So it's very important that we should have the bhikshuni ordination. So this is due to not having developed a special realization of the great significance and the difficulty of finding a life of leisure and resources. So far, while wandering in samsara, we may probably have had very rare occasion of finding such optimum life, but at that, so with regards to the denigrating denying karma, there are non-Buddhists who do assert karma. And Christianity and other traditions also talk about going to hell if you commit negative actions and so forth. And so this is also same in some other non-Buddhist traditions. So all the different religious traditions have their own God or teacher and God and teachers. We take the object of refuge, the triple gym, and the teacher as someone who shows us the path. So, with regard to keeping faith in one's higher, higher source of power or something, the God or the different terms that are used, it is there in all the traditions, religious traditions. So in fact, in when you talk about the keeping single-pointed faith in the God, the Creator, and so forth, God and the theistic religions, they are very powerful as well. Therefore, we have to respect all traditions. And so in the other traditions, of course, they do not have the teacher, a teacher who showed the path or the understanding of the teaching, who gave the teaching on selflessness, and thereby using that understanding, overcoming negative vittis and becoming sangha and so forth. It's not there. So with regard to non-violence, practice of non-violence, compared to us, the Jains have much more intense practice, greater practice in this regard. But the difference is lies in the understanding of the philosophical view. And so, as I said before, monks and nuns of nuns, Christian monks and nuns, amazing. They live very simple and humble, contented life, and then also serving others. They are not, if not lesser, of course, they are not, if not greater, they are not lesser than us. And so they do practice what are to be adopted and discard those to be discarded. The negative actions, they cultivate positive ones. So I know a Christian brother, John Main, and I met him in Canada one time, and he sang a hymn to God with the music. And as he was doing that, his eyes welled up with water, and he was in tears. And so they also have these kinds of intense faith in their God and to the extent of going through such experience of shedding tears and the hairs on their body standing on end. So, of course, we talk about differentiating between Buddhist and non-Buddhist traditions on the basis of taking refuge or not, but mainly it has to be based on the understanding of the philosophical view of which refers to the four seals of the Dharma. So the action meditation, identifying the freedom and resources, considering its great significance, and considering difficulty in finding it. So with regard to the resources that you have, there it mentions about not being handicapped and so forth. So once when I reached Koksar, after passing the Rotang La Pass from Manali, I met some villagers, the local villagers there, and they brought us bread and tea and served us. And I told them that I told them that you are all Buddhists, aren't you? And they said yes. And what is Buddhism about? I asked, and they said taking refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And I asked, who is the Buddha? And they said they didn't know. And then I asked again, is Buddha Shakyamuni same as the Brahma, the God, the great God? They said yes. And so how? What kind of faith should we actually think they have? So what do you think if they are actually taking refuge in the Brahma and so forth, these gods, like the Buddha himself? So what we need is a faith grounded in reason. By seeing the reason, we should be able to take have faith in the three jewels. Not just taking for granted what our teachers tell us, because one teacher may tell us one thing and another teacher who is more who has a more sharper tongue will say another thing, and we might take that as well to be true. So what we need to do is we need to examine whether that object is something which is worth taking, keeping our faith in. So this is done with our wisdom, not with just faith. And so with regard to faith itself, if you don't have some understanding of selflessness, then that faith may also be a diluted one, which is like a faith influenced by it grasping a true existence. As Abhisamaya Alamkara mentions, there is this very subtle attachment or passion towards the three victorious ones and so forth. And so, perhaps I may be saying too much. If you actually take the Buddha to be solidly, independently, absolute kind of an entity, and take refuge in him, then that kind of refuge is intinged by this grasping at true existence. And then, of course, faith is taught very strongly in the reliance on the guru, such as the benefit of relying on a guru, not disadvantage of not relying on a guru, and then disadvantage of or the faults of wrong reliance. And then we also say that the Lama has to be regarded or seen as the as a Buddha. And then how, if you ask, how do you actually see the Lama as? Then if you don't have any, you may not have any answer. Henley. Dahanu. So His Holiness once went to Dahanu region of Ladakh by helicopter, and many of the local people had come to listen to the teaching. So I told them that they knew the verse of taking refuge in bodhicitta. And I asked them to raise those who knew this verse by heart to raise their hands, and everyone raised their hands. And then I asked, how many of you understand the meaning of this verse and raise your hands? And there wasn't anyone. And there was a tantric practitioner who raised his hand, but I was doubtful. I suspected if he really knew the meaning of this verse. Well, so perhaps not to lose his face, he may have raised his hands, but I should have actually examined him, taken gave a test. So we take for granted this with regard to faith, and then ultimately we might say that, oh, I have faith in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha because of my grandparents telling me. So how do you, if somebody asks, how do you actually take refuge? And why do you take refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha? It's big, you would say, oh, I do this because of my parents, grandparents do this. So otherwise, we do not need. If we just, if this is sufficient, we need no. We don't need those of the 300 plus volumes of Kanjur and Tenjur. At the end of the Lineage Lama, Lamrim Lineage Lama prayer request prayer, at the end of the wisdom lineage, so Mamize, with regard to Atisha and Dromtempa, it is said that they were the two ornaments of the world. So it's not because they were famous. They were not praised in that way because they practiced the non-violence. But because of the wisdom related to the profound view, so of course there are so many texts which talk about keeping faith in both Buddhist and non-Buddhist traditions, and then there are 10 billion Christians and also 10 billion 1 billion 1 billion Christians and 1 billion Muslims and Hindus and so forth. So all of them have faith in their own gods, respective God. And so that alone will not make someone the adornment of this world. But understanding the suchness and the reality of, or the reality of dependent origination, and makes one the ornament. And so wisdom is primary. We should make it primary. So for me too, wisdom mainly helps. So if you don't know what enlightenment is, how can a bodhicitta arise in you? What is meant by chang and chup in Tibetan for enlightenment? Chang in the sense of purification and chup in the sense of knowing everything. And in the commentary to the lamp of the 25,000 verses of Pajaparamita, commentary to Abhisamaya Alamkara by Vimukti, Vimukti Sena, it mentions that with wisdom, the bodhisattvas focus on on enlightenment, and with compassion, they focus on sentient beings. So if we take faith to be the primary, if you only talk about faith, then it seems that those who do not have much learning of the philosophical texts seem to be have greater faith, and those who are students of philosophy seem to have less of it. But that's not what we should have. So we should have this faith through reasoning, understanding that the Buddha is someone who taught us the dependent origination, its reality. And so it's not the case that when you do practice, the faith is primary, and when you do analysis, study, then wisdom is the primary. So what we need to do is actually counter these negative emotions that we have, not just being gentle and so forth, but we need to actually see the deception of these grasping at true existence. That has to be actually, we have to be able to do that by using our intelligence, critical analysis, and then understanding the emptiness. And with that, with the help of that understanding, then, of course, to train our mind, we need to go into the understanding of the subtle impermanence and sufferings and selflessness. And then with regard to the Four Noble Truths, the four characteristics of each of these, we should meditate on them. And so on a daily basis, I do this kind of analysis on the basis of these 16 characteristics, and then bodhicitta. And then I also do in the reflection screening meditation the 37 harmonies of enlightenment, and so these are very, very powerful and helpful to meditate on and analyze. So in order to practice the Dhamma, one must be free from those life forms of barbarians born into the borderland regions and may have and gain a human life. So, of course, you talk about Buddhahood, but if you ask what Buddha is, you won't understand. And then for that reason, you will not understand the Dharma and the Sangha as well. And so how do you actually verify that they are truth? You would just have to rub your hand, scratch your head, and keep silence. So if someone actually comes up with reasons and challenge you that the three objects of refuge are not there, then you may also follow that person because you have no good understanding. So you should be free from wrong views. So although these are available to us, if we lack all the conducive facilities, there is no way to we can practice the Dharma, yet we lack nothing of those necessary provisions, the food, clothing, shelter, bed, for bed and etc. for our practice. Therefore, the compassionate heart of others is also intact. In brief, we are not born in those eight places for which we have prayed. May I not be born, and we are not born in the 10 places for which we have prayed. May I be born, etc. Since we have attained this human body with 18 features of leisure and resources, our past prayers have hit home for us. To take a full circle in us, and having heard lots of teachings with explanatory guidance on Lam Rim from the gurus, and given my level of knowledge, I have comparatively a good intellect or understanding resulting from listening and reflection. At a time when the conditions such as sickness, age, and happiness, by persevering with all my ability, it would be a much greater loss than losing an invaluable wish-granting gem, which has been found but caused to lose without having been used it. And so, if you don't understand the Dharma well, and so only on the basis of this kind of human life, human physical basis, we can practice the bodhicitta, the view of emptiness and selflessness and so forth. And then, when you see the value of these practices, you will be able to see how this life is the precious one. And therefore, Aryadeva says that if you don't use this life properly, correctly, then you might, on this basis, you might create causes for yourself to be born in the lower realms of existence. Therefore, you should pray fervently. From now on until my death, I will try, by all means, to leave as much imprint of the entire path as possible. May the Guru Deity bless me so that I could do that. Thus invoke your Guru's kindness and meditate. If you like, you may also do the nectar flowing purification. Second, considering it great significance, while visualizing the Guru Deity on your crown, think as follows: the optimum life is hugely meaningful in terms of short-term achievements. It affords us to practice these things with ease and comfort, to observe ethical precepts, a course for achieving an extraordinary body of a human or deity in the higher status, to extend generosity, a cause for achieving great wealth, to cultivate patience, a cause for acquiring excellent retinue. Also, if you wished for its very, very special physical basis, which is qualified by either the sevenfold attributes of high status or the fourfold wheel or the eightfold ripened effects, we can cultivate the full collection of causes of each of them in this life. Besides, even if you wish to go to the pure lands of to Shita Sukhavati and others, life basis of the optimal life allows the creation of causes for birth in them. And whatever powerful root virtues you wish to cultivate in connection with the special fields of marriage, the supreme three jewels, etc., you can do that in this life while maintaining the ethical support underpinned by vows of the earlier vows and or later. And so, therefore, the immense merit one can create in a human life is very difficult for others to other forms of transmigratory beings. Further, an ordinary being so of the higher realms of existence are drunk with meditative concentration all the time and have no possibility of developing disenchantment to samsara. They cannot achieve the freshly developed Arya path in that life form, except for few who possess an imprint from their acquaintance with the path through a series of human births in the past, where most of the desire realm gods are said to be in unleisurely situations. Hence, human life is proclaimed the best as physical form for gods as to be in leisurely situations, hence for accomplishing the path of liberation. And from amongst humans, those of the Kuru land are unworthy of precepts, and the humans of the other islands, Videsha and Gocharya, have very strong stupidity and confusion. Hence, the humans of Jambudvipa are extraordinarily superior. And if one could make the practice of path of liberation one's essence without confusing the ethical choice of right and wrong, one could make huge strides in this life. Letter to Disciples by Chandra Gomins mentions that the way of initial powerful precious spirit of enlightenment, the yardstick of the path of the Supreme Vehicle, is developed on the basis of human body. It cannot be done in other life bases. So this life basis is definitely the wonderful, most wonderful life for cultivating Mahayana path, especially since in this kind of life, which is womb-born and have the six vital elements, one can become a Buddha in a single lifetime of a degenerate age by relying on the path of the highest yoga tantra. Such a life is praised as the best form of life. As such, it is said that an object of admiration, even for the bodhisattvas in the land of bliss, the Sukhavati. So, while I have found this excellent life with which I can easily achieve all the short and long-term goals, if I do not make it meaningful as much as I could, it would be analogous to a poor person who has arrived in an island of precious gems, idling away his time in merriment, like song and dance. Instead of picking gems and then finishing his provisions, lives on loaned food and returns home empty-handed. Likewise, while having arrived by chance at the precious island, like optimum human life, if you only indulge in the frivolous things of this life, like seeking material gains, honor and fame, instead of obtaining even a slight bit of virtue for lasting happiness, which is like a wish-granting gem, whilst having exhausting the fruits of virtues gathered in the past by using them up in this life and collect the loan-like sins through various means, and hence avert this. And hence revert. So it seems that the Amdo edition and the central Tibetan edition of this text seems to have some difference in the words. And hence revert again to the old permanent home, the lower realms of existence. Hence, what most grassly deception could there be to oneself than this? Though, after having continuously passed through the relentless bad states of birth, like the three lower realms of existence, etc., for so long we have now become free from that and gained this opportune life basis. Just this once, if we now knowingly plunge into the abysmal, miserable lower states, again, by throwing our everlasting goal to the wind, despite the critical intellect, we have to examine the good and bad, then it is a sign of mindlessness. Therefore, we will make meaningful whatever fleeting lifespan is left without wasting it to the best of our ability. Thus pray, may the Guru Deity bless us to be able to do it. Having thus prayed, imagine, and in order to develop the extraordinary conviction, realizing the great significance of optimal life, and also the special, and then develop within the mind stream of oneself and others. Third, considering the difficulty of the finding this optimum life has two paths. Of these, the first is difficulty of finding on account of the causes. So while visualizing Guru Deity on your crown thing like this, this optimum life of leisure and resources is not only significant but also very difficult to attain. For most of humans these days take side of non-virtue and enthusiastically create grave sins, but very rarely do they seem to cultivate virtue. Therefore, after their death from here, except for one or two of them, there is no doubt they will most probably be reborn. most probably be reborn in the lower realms of existence. While our children are unable to learn the Dharma, even when taught, they are naturally apt at lying and other sins without being taught to do so. From this, it seems easy to understand or realize that there are more people who create the causes for rebirth in the unfortunate realms, and for oneself too, on top of the unfathomable sins accumulated in the past, in this life also, due to the past habits. Whatever non-virtues we indulge are more powerful while we do not endeavor, but for the superficial virtue, and we have a very slim chance to purify the sin amassed in the past and to restrain them in the future, because of which we would immediately after death have to be reborn in the unfortunate realms. If for each moment of sin, such as an anger toward a bodhisattva, we must remain in unrelenting hell for eons, then it goes without saying that we would remain in the lower realms of the lower realms for many eons by the force of the infinite sins, which were created in our birth since time beginless, but which have not yielded their results, nor have they been destroyed by their antidotes, and that that are in our mind stream. Once we are born in the lower realms, we will be ignorant about cultivating virtue, but automatically commit sins continually, and hence will not be even hear the name higher realms. Therefore, the past Kadamba masters have said, it is much easier to achieve Buddhahood in the life basis of leisure and resources than it is to attain a life basis of freedom and resources from escaping the eight realms without respite. Generally, to attain a mere happy realm, one must commit a single pure wholesome deed underpinned by a pure ethical morality. Particularly to gain a human life with complete freedom and resources, not any course will do, but you need many root causes such as pure morality as foundation, the perfection of generosity, etc., as support, and impeccably prayers as complement. So the 7 billion people on this earth, of them, 90% perhaps are mostly thinking of material development. And this is because of the educational system, which is oriented towards the material development, and also teaching us to be more selfish. And so the in the past, the monastics had less distraction, but today there are more distractions in the world. And therefore, we should be able to make a difference in our through our education to actually be able to cope with it. It's not be getting distracted. As Kadamba masters in the past had said, that if you have all the Dharma within yourself, you are confident, then you will be able to deal with any situation in the world. And Jabjisharambuche and Ling Rambuche had been to Switzerland, and then Ling Rambuche had been to other places as well. So when he came back, they told me that the people in the West seem to be indulged or be carried away by the sensual objects, the pleasure of sensual objects, and do nothing about the impermanence and suffering nature. And so for us also, this seems to be happening. So we seem to appreciate these the sense objects and the material progress and too much. And so it's not just when we think about suffering, we should not only focus on suffering of suffering, but also think about the changeable suffering, and particularly the pervasive conditioning suffering. of samsara, as Panchen Lobsang Chögyen has said. And so the Buddha is saying this is suffering, and the true suffering refers to this third deeper suffering. So we need to be aware of it. So there are non-Buddhist practitioners. We can see during Mahakumbh Mela, the great festival of gathering of the Hindus. And so these Hindu masters, practitioners, live up in the Himalayan mountains, the snow mountains, in throughout the year. And so the new Tibetan, Indian Prime Minister actually practices the 9-day fasting. And so he did that even when he visited during his visit to America. So the president gave a luncheon, but he could not take the meal because he was fasting. So this shows how strong a strong integrity in him. So, of course, his practice is based on the solid Atma theory, but we are talking about selflessness and so forth, but we are not able to do that kind of practice strongly. So in Brahmanavartika, it mentions that if you take only water, then there is mention, according to the non-Buddhist traditions, that you'll be able to purify your body and purify your sin and so forth. But it is considered as one of the five features of a foolish practitioner or who has gone astray from the right path in terms of wisdom. And so, if we also do such practice, then without understanding of much concentration and understanding of selflessness and so forth, then it would be the same, doing the same kind of practice as the non-Buddhists. The Nyungne practice. So it's very important to understand this conditioning, pervasive existential suffering. So most of the people today are almost like lifestyles makes them akin to the animals, because the animals only rely on their sensory perceptions more, and then they actually enjoy the sensorial objects. And so if we as humans also only think like that, then we are same as animals. And we become servants of the sensual objects, and without any introduction and understanding of how the negative emotions cause us suffering and so forth, then not being able to use our intelligence, we are like animals. And so it's quite sad that we think that happiness comes from outside these sensual objects, and not by using our mind with this intelligence. So the reason for this is, by pure morality, it means applying mindfulness and introspection in the three doors, with the three doors constantly, that one does not transgress the boundary of vows pledged, and even when you are occasionally tainted by slight infringement. So with regard to generosity and others, even small virtue you pride in are meant either for preventing unwanted situations of just this life, or an imitation of others, or merely some fascination for fame. But it seems almost impossible that you do them motivated by the thought to pursue the goal of next life. And so for the dogs, of course, they do not have any kind of thought about next life and so forth. But we as humans, we have this intelligence. We do create all kinds of, we indulge in all kinds of emotions through attachment and anger and so forth. So the text is talking about creating negative emotions and negative karmas through our negative emotions and then leading ourselves to lower realms of existence. And therefore, we are like dogs. So in certain Lamrim, they start from the teaching on the Buddha nature. Such as Sharava's Lamrim, which is Jabjishnara Moshe told me once. I have not seen the text. And so Thargyan also does that. And so you have to think when you introduce the teaching on the basis of the Buddha nature, we really need to give lots of thought to this. So we have found this precious life, and also you met with the guru. So if we have to go to lower realms of existence in such an opportune life, it's really a great loss. So whatever lifespan I have left with, I will do a practice of the entire, containing the entire path. So may the Guru please bless me to be able to do this. So with regard to spending your life, doing meditation on the entire range of the path, of course, there's difference in terms of people's mental dispositions, intellect, and so forth. For some, it would be more effective if they are led through teaching on the reliance on a guru, and then about the life with leisure and resources, and so forth. And so these have to be more reliant on quotations, so it's more difficult. But if we think about the exchanging, equaling, and exchanging self and others, as is taught in the Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, it's much more powerful. You can see the reasons. So if we look at the dogs, we can see the more gentle and kind the dogs are, the more friends they have amongst them. Whereas someone who is very selfish remains lonely. So if that is the case with the dogs, then we as humans must be able to do things where we consider others more important than ourselves and have compassion and love towards them and exchange our happiness and with the suffering of others. So even in this life alone, when we live aside the next lives, we'll see the benefit, concrete benefit of cherishing others over oneself. And so by understanding this kind of practice, well, then you can actually, you should go into the understanding of the three jewels, and then on the basis of that, you can see how your master is so significant and meaningful to you. And so that kind of understanding will make a difference in gaining realizations. So it is very fortunate that I have this opportunity to practice the Dharma now. And therefore, when you should make your best effort to be able to spend your time in meditating on the entire range of the path as best you can. Then how to make meaningful has three parts. So we'll switch to the liberation in the palm of your hand. So we are on page 271. 307. How to train, having relied on the guru. So second thinking, how to how to rely. So even if you have taken someone as your teacher, and that teacher actually tells us to do things which are not in accord with the scriptures, then how should we go about with that? Jerome Boucher says that if the teacher tells us to do something which is not in accord with the Dharma, then we should actually question it. And then also, if the Lama, the Guru, tells us to do virtuous things, we should decline doing it. And so in the Tantric context also, it is said that if through your by using your reason, if you think that you are not able to practice what the teacher tells you to do, then you have to actually discuss and clarify it. And therefore, following this principle, Arya Vimukti Sena, actually, who was a disciple of Vasubandhu, wrote his commentary on Abhisamaya Alamkara from the Madhyamaka point of view, unlike his own teacher, Vasubandhu's stand of Chittamatra view. So he said, Haribhadra says in his clear meaning that seeing what his teacher had done is not right interpretation. He actually explained Abhisamaya Alamkara from the Madhyamaka point of view. And as I said before, Master Nagarjuna also checked has said that certain teachings of the Buddha, of course, they were the words of the Buddha, but then And so even in the epistemological tradition, it is said that one master who was a disciple of Dharmakirti, his name Wong Chukde, Ishwarasena, was not able to understand Dharmakirti's text fully, and therefore his the Dignaga's disciple, and then Dharmakirti actually diverted from his way of interpreting the Dignaga's epistemology, text on epistemology. And so this doesn't mean that these masters who have actually gone separate, would interpret the text differently from their own teachers, have lost their reliance, the practice of relying on a guru at all, but they were critically analyzing the teachings and going after the truth. So the proper, the 270 down, the proper graduated training should be undertaken after you have begun to rely on your spiritual guide. This has two headings: the stimulus to take in essence of your optimum human birth and rebirth, and how to extract that meaning. So when you have when you are actually very enthusiastic about how precious this life is, then and if you have to think about the impermanence of this life, and I have a friend monk who had actually suffered soglong one time of hypertension or something, and I asked why he had this, and he said because of meditation on impermanence. So as if you are a real practitioner, you should not have that kind of fear of impermanence of death, impermanence of death. So when we debate, we said whatever is produced through causes and conditions is impermanent, necessarily impermanent. And then in the Vaibhashika system, they talk about a birth of something and then abiding and then disintegrating and finally going out of existence. And we have to actually follow what the the Svatantika philosophy and upwards say about things which are produced, saying that things which are produced must necessarily be subject to change. And therefore, we learn this even right at the beginning of our study of collected topics and so forth. And then, of course, death, when we talk about impermanence and of death, then impermanence and death, then we are actually talking about a gross level of impermanence. And so Master Nagarjuna says that impermanence, suffering and selflessness are and emptiness are for actually training your mind. So when you think about the suffering of death, I mean, you should not feel despondent. So the discussion to convince you, the last two headings form a scheme that applies all the meditation topics that follow. This is a traditional way to combine formal discourse material with material from informal discourse. You should just substitute each meditation topic, such as the one I shall now discuss under both headings, for heading on how to pursue the main part of the meditation session. You must do what I explain in the session on devotion to spiritual guides. Join that. And so we need to understand what, recognize what Buddhism is about. For that, it's indispensable for recognizing the three jewels. So without that, you will not be able to have a full conviction of this kind of life, the optimum life, being precious. And therefore, we need to have first faith, based on reason, and then develop aspiration and feel inspired to do the practices. So when you think of about the great benefits and the rarity of Tamam Rebirth, you will feel involuntarily happy, and when you think of death and permanence, you will feel involuntarily sad. These are three headings here. There are three headings here: identifying the optimum human rebirth, thinking about great benefit, its great benefit, and thinking about how difficult it is to acquire. So, regarding the identification. Has two parts, its freedom and endowments. The freedom, you must identify optimum human rebirth before you can want to extract the essence from it. Your hearthstone may be made of gold, but if you don't know it, you will still be a pauper. You must also from the beginning identify the freedoms, that is, being free of the eight states unfavorable to Dharma practice. These eight unfavorable states are mentioned in Nagarjuna's letter to a friend: upholding wrong view, being an animal, hungry ghost, being born in hell realm, being without a victor's teaching, being born in a remote place as a barbarian, as an idiot or mute, or as long-lived god. Any of these rebirths of the one is one of the eight faulty, unfavorable states. Because you have gained a favorable state free from these, strive to block your future rebirths. So when you think about the suffering of the three lower realms of existence, as it is said in the second words of Manjushri by the fifth Dalai Lama, you actually have to feel those sufferings, those pains and misery on yourself when you think about those realms, and not just looking at some kind of a show and do the meditation. So a rebirth, the four unfavorable human states are as follows. The hells are unfavorable for Dharma practice because of the intense suffering of heat and cold. If someone put a glowing ember on your head and ordered you to meditate at the same time, the pain would prevent you from even beginning to meditate. If we were now born in hell, we would feel 100,000 times more suffering than a live rat placed in a red-hot iron frying pan. So far as practicing the Dharma or even hearing one word of Dharma, our mind would only be filled with suffering, and all we would do is stay there and be without Dharma. We should feel lucky not to have been born there. Rebirth as hungry ghost is unfavorable for Dharma practice because when we are extremely hungry, because of great hunger and thirst, when we are extremely hungry and thirsty, and our guru, for instance, urges us to practice Dharma, instead we only yearn for food and drink first. This rebirth is therefore also unfavorable for the practice of Dharma. How lucky we are not born as hungry ghosts. A rebirth in an animal is unfavorable for Dharma practice because of animal stupidity and benighted ignorance. For example, if someone told a donkey, recite Om Mani Padme Hum once and you will then be enlightened, that they wouldn't understand at all. If they don't know how to recite even a syllable of Om Mani Padme Hum, and how could they understand any other Dharma? So animals only experience their particular forms of suffering, and is unfavorable for the Dharma practice. How extremely unlucky we are not born there. At present, whenever we say how lucky, we are referring to some money we might have made, but this is not really being lucky at all. When we look at animals as just dogs and donkeys, we should not treat them as objects of curiosity. We should feel how lucky I am not to be like that. The long-lived gods. So amongst the Muslims, there are many people who are dedicated for the welfare of others, serving others. So of course, philosophically, they have this view of the Creator God, which from the point of view of a Buddhist, of course, is a wrong view. But if you, even as a Muslim, if they are really dedicated to serve others, to have kind heart, then of course it's good. and a genuine qualified practitioner of Muslim say some say that should not cause bloodshed, because if you cause bloodshed, then you are actually harming somebody, and that actually eliminates you from that group of the practitioner of Islam. And some Muslim friends also have told me, not just any ordinary unlearned Muslim, but someone, a friend of mine, who told me that jihad means combating against your own negative emotions. It has nothing, it doesn't mean fighting with others and killing others. And I also, this was also confirmed to me by other Muslim scholars. So here is it's mentioned that in relation to a Muslim, the text mentions that this is the worst kind of unfortunate state or case. But that has to be understood on relative terms. We should not take it like literally. So the five endowments in relation to no matter what. Five personal endowments on page 273. So the first five personal endowments, the Shravaka level C, born a human in central land, having all one's faculties, not perverted by the heinous crimes, and having enduring faith. The first personal endowment is being human. This is particularly superior to the other migrations in its potential for carrying out the practices that benefit one's future rebirths. We are now most but definitely human beings, but it doesn't seem to have helped us. Being born in central land means being born in reborn in a central place that is under the influence of words of Dharma, and that has at least four members of Sangha. Having all one's faculties means, and having all one's senses organs, sense organs from birth, all also hermaphrodites, eunuchs, and so on are not suitable candidates for pratimoksha vows. And as you have not been born as one of these, you have all your faculties. Not being perverted by the heinous crimes means that one will not achieve arhatship in this life with one. If one has committed these crimes, we have not committed these, so we are not perverted by the heinous crimes. And then with regard to one Sakya master, in the beginning of early on in his life, he had actually objected to Jai Rinpoche with 18 different arguments against Jai Rinpoche. But then later on, he actually saw the quality of Jetsongkhapa and found great faith and admiration in him. Dabashera Rinchen was the Lotsawa. Dabashera Rinchen was the master, I think. So So now thinking about the great benefits of optimum human rebirth is so in great benefits of short term, great benefit in long term, and in short, thinking of how even every moment of it can be most beneficial. It's great benefits from the short term point of view. Page 176. So you might wonder, how could I ever achieve a higher rebirth of a wealthy and happy, good, or a god or a human? But there's no doubt that you can. All you have to do is practice. So if you wish to achieve your next rebirth as Brahma, Indra, or Universal Monarch, you can. If you want a rebirth that has the eight good qualities from karmic ripening, or a higher rebirth with seven good qualities, or the right physical rebirth for the four wheels of Supreme Vehicle, the four classes of Tantra, you can achieve them. In this rebirth, you can also achieve causes to be reborn in Pure Land, Sukhavati, Shambhala, and so on. Longdo Lama made his optimum human rebirth meaningful by practicing in the hermitage. He showed little interest in even a single bowl of barley flour. He practiced in order to collect the causes to be reborn as the king of Shambhala. After he had made these prayers, he thought he should now make an offering to the Benchen Lama Peldanisha. He asked Benchen Lama, "Will I achieve my aim?" The Benchen Lama knew what he meant and said, "The old Lama is being really greedy. You will achieve your aim." It's great benefits from the ultimate point of view. In order to achieve liberation, you must cultivate the... So Benjamin Panchenishi has written a guide to Shambhala. I have seen it once. I don't know how that could be. And it is there's a story that Benjamin Panchenishi himself had visited Shambhala and brought some grains which were kept in Podala. I've seen that. So the guide, with regard to the guide, it's quite difficult to go there using that kind of guide. Perhaps you need to do special retreat meditations to be able to fulfill given there. So in order to achieve liberation, you must cultivate the path... Dharma path of achieving it, for achieving that of the three higher trainings, the first of which is ethics. Let us take the Pratimoksha vow as an example. You must cultivate renunciation in order to develop or imprint these vows on your mind stream, but it is difficult to develop things like renunciation or other migration states. For example, as gods and so on, the inhabitants of Kuru are not suitable candidates for these vows, and of the humans... On the other three continents, those of Jambudvipa, the southern continent, this earth, are the best candidates. One develops the most powerful bodhicitta in human rebirth. Chandragomin's letter to disciple tells humans achieve the strongest bodhicitta. The god Nagas don't achieve this on the path. Neither do demigods, Garudas, knowledge bearers, or python spirits. The same applies to the vows of Sikha Tantra. The human form is also the best and most powerful rebirth in which to reach omniscience. Even a beginner in this sort of rebirth can, through the secret tantric path, become enlightened in one lifetime in the one body. This is because one must karmically possess the six physical constituents and be born from a human womb of a human of the southern continent. We have received such a rebirth. We should pray to receive such a rebirth again. Even the Bodhisattvas and Sukhavati pray to be reborn in this continent. We could not have found a better rebirth than our present one, the only exception being those of us who were not born as males. The Shakyamuni statue in Lhasa Cathedral is supposed to have a wish-granting jewel in its knees. Some people circumambulate the statue and say, "May I achieve whatever I pray for?" They make such trite prayers. If you had many hundreds of thousands of wish-granting gems and turned some of them into cushions and some into pillows and sat on them, they would not help you to stay out of them. So by averting the bodhicitta helps you avert lower realms of existence and leads you to higher realms of existence and also to the deathless state. And so what happens is through the practice of the bodhicitta, you would also achieve higher rebirth and the nirvana, which come as byproduct, of course, because your ultimate goal is Buddhahood. And therefore, that is what you achieve ultimately through the bodhicitta. And so each of us has received the same rebirth as Jalamilarepa, except that we do not practice the Dharma. No qualitative distinctions can be drawn between Milarepa's rebirth and ours. For example, we can understand that there is a difference between Milarepa and the King of the Nagas. The King of the Nagas has piles of wish-granting gems in his hoard, and he wears jeweled ornaments on his head and so on, but he was not able even to close the gate of the lower realms, let alone reach enlightenment. Milarepa was so poor that he did not even have barley flour, flour to eat, but he had received this precious optimum human life and so was enlightened in that very life. Such thoughts give meaning to this optimum human rebirth. Mahayogi told Geshe Chengawa. Najorba Chenpo taught Geshe Chengawa to take it easy, but Chengawa replied that he was working as hard as he was because this optimum rebirth was so hard to find. What a great shame if this rebirth you have gained is not used meaningfully. This is like a pauper finding a sack full of gold and losing it before spending even the smallest amount. And thinking briefly about how even every moment of it can be most beneficial. The literature is not clear about this heading, which supplements the other two on the way in which the optimum human rebirth is so very beneficial. The oral instruction is as follows. The rebirth has the additional great benefit of holding very great every day, every moment you... Great benefit every day, every moment you'll create immeasurable causes for this liberation, for your liberation and omniscience. If you do not let even the short time it takes to burn a stick of incense go by without making use of it, and for example, work hard to build up the accumulations or purify yourself of obscurations. So it is a mistake not to regret wasting regret wasting our optimum human rebirth, and yet to regret wasting one or two silver coins. Aryashura said, like a trader going to an island of jewels, returning home empty-handed. In other words, the trader goes to an island of jewels, does not acquire any jewel, gets heavily in debt to boot, and returns home empty-handed. We only acquire this human rebirth once. There would be no greater pity than if we failed to practice Dharma, just accumulated sins, and then went to lower realms. Think about how difficult optimum rebirth is to acquire. This section has three headings. Thinking about the cause for its being so hard to acquire. So your optimum human rebirth, which could be most beneficial, is extremely difficult to acquire. You do not receive it again. If it were not so difficult to obtain, you could let it now go by without using it meaningfully. Then when you obtain it another time, it would be enough to make sure you use the next rebirth meaningfully. But this fully endowed human rebirth that you have received was created out of many causes and conditions. You have been lucky by virtue of your merit and the prayers you made. It would be difficult to receive the same thing in the future. Once, when a Mongolian Lama was giving Dharma teaching, a Chinese man said, "Oh, that's because the Lama has never been to China himself. There are so many people there." This is quite wrong. Though there are many people in general, what good is that to you if you go to the lower realms? regardless of whether there are many human beings in the external world or not. You must look in with valid inferential cognition to see if you do not have in your mind stream all the necessary causes for the optimum rebirth. You can tell that you can then tell whether or not it will be hard for you to receive such a rebirth in future. For example, in the external world, the autumn harvest of barley, wheat, and so on are the outcome of spring planting. Further, you won't get any flowers growing in flower pot if you don't plant any seed. So as I usually recite this verse from the 400 verses, first avert the non and meritorious actions. So even if you get rid of the non-meritorious karmas, you cannot still trust that fully, because you may create negative karmas that you would lead you to lower realms of existence. And therefore, we need to actually put effort on the understanding selflessness. Not only focusing on the 10 virtuous actions and avoiding 10 non-virtuous actions, but mainly focusing our practice on understanding of selflessness, that would really be leave a powerful imprint and cause us to overcome the negative emotions, and we would be able to create causes for a better rebirth in the next life. And in this way, we can actually progress along the path from lifetime to lifetime. And therefore, in the context of Buddhism, where our main focus and of practice should be understanding, developing this understanding insight into selflessness. And so on this kind of basis, so if we do not confuse ourselves in terms of the sequence of practices leading us to higher rebirth, so, of course, even if you may age, you should be able to practice this kind of path without being partial, but being able to do the sequential practices. And then some analogies for the difficulty of acquiring it. Geshe Podawa says in his analogies, grass of the roof of a tower, a neck of a turtle, which means the following. Rebirth into the upper realms are generally as frequent as the grass that grows on the mountain slopes. But a human rebirth with all the freedoms and endowments is extremely rare as blades of grass on the roofs of the houses. And the neck of a turtle means this. Suppose there is a golden yolk floating on the great ocean being blown by the wind. The yolk has only one hole, and a blind turtle living in the ocean pokes its head out of the ocean surface, on the ocean surface just once every 100 years. The turtle's head would probably not come up through the yolk. We are similarly in the great ocean of samsara. Owing to the power of our delusions, the eyes of our wisdom are closed, and we normally wander from one state into the lower realms and to another. In the lower realms to another. Occasionally, we get free of the lower realms and attain the ord. A rebirth in the human state by virtue of the laws of probability, but the world is enormous, and there are worlds in all the cardinal intermediate points of the compass. We cannot be sure where in these worlds the Buddha's teachings flourish or where they will not be going. They will be going. These teachings are like the golden yolk, and meeting with them is only also extremely rare. If the turtle constantly swam in the ocean surface, swam to the ocean surface, he would probably be meet with a yolk from time to time. But if he only surfaces every 100 years, he will only ever meet it once. If we, as in the analogy, received human rebirths frequently, we could possibly meet up with the stitching wherever they occur. But this is not the case. Only occasionally we receive one or two human rebirths. If the golden yolk stayed in one place for a long time, the turtle would not surface at the exact place. But at least there would be a chance he might hit the right place a few times and so meet with the yolk. But this is not the not in fact the case. The yolk moves in random in all 10 directions on the huge expanse of the ocean surface. And in, as in the analogy, if the Buddha's teaching always stayed in the same world, we would possibly meet with them a few times when we gained human rebirth. But we cannot be sure that a Buddha's teaching will remain in a particular place or world. And in any case, such teachings would only be remain there for a very short while. Then it's difficult by nature to acquire Many beings practice non-virtue, few practice virtue. When beings leave their rebirths in the higher and lower realms, the vast majority go to the lower realms. So very few leave rebirths in either realm and go to the upper realms. But that the Tathagata, in his basic teachings on the Vinaya, said he, the beings who go from upper realms to lower realms, or who go from the lower to back to lower, are like the dust particles in the vast earth. The number of beings who go from the lower to upper, or from upper to upper, back to the upper, are like the dust, like the dust particles that fit on the tip of a finger. Among the six types of rebirths, there are generally very few beings who are humans. There are fewer hungry ghosts than hell beings, still fewer animals, and fewer land animals than marine. This is like the fact that hundreds of millions of flies can fit into a space that will not hold 10 humans. There are very many beings in the Bardo, so many that it is like the many hundreds of thousands of flies that immediately gather around a dead horse's corpse, or even 100 such corpses. There are still just the same number of flies for each at the ready. Even among human rebirths, it is extremely rare to be reborn, to be born during the eons of illumination, that is, in an aeon of Buddhas to come, when the Buddhas come to the world. And each aeon of illumination is separated by many aeons of thousands of aeons of darkness. Even within each aeon of illumination, there are 80 minor aeons, 20 minor aeons of void, and 80 minor aeons, and 30 minors eons of void, and 20 minor eons of formation, 20 stasis and destruction. The Buddhas do not come to the world during 60 of these minor aeons, during the aeon of void, formation and destruction, nor do they come to the world at certain times during the 20 minor aeons of stasis, during the first and the last of these 20 minor aeons, when humans have immeasurable lifespan, and at those times when human lifespan are on the increase. Buddhas only come during the dark ages when human spans are decreasing. Let us talk about this present time of our birth in the southern continent. Buddhas come during the 18 intervening minor eons when human lifespan follows a life cyclic pattern. We could have been born when a previous Buddha had to come to common appearances, gone to Nirvana, and his doctrines died. Birth during this period, before the coming of the next Buddha, is so no different from birth in an eon of darkness. But we were not born at such a time. They say that after these teachings die out, 4.9 billion human years will elapse before Maitreya, Buddha comes, but we were also not born during this intervening dark age. The Buddha's teachings still exist, and we were born in the southern continent, and the only place where these teachings can be found. We were born in one of these few countries in this continent where the teachings are widespread, and such countries like Tibet, Mongolia, and are in the minority only a few. We were born in Tibet, one of the foundations allowing the Dharma to thrive. But here is an example of what happens in Tibet. Kushri Gyasang, a Mongolian, once said, "When I went to Teshikil Monastery in Amdo, there were several thousand monks of these. About 500 were geshes, about 500 were traders, about 500 were neither. In a single family, there may be 10 brothers, but only 2 or 3 of them will enter monasteries. And even among people in monasteries, those who practice Dharma purely by putting the Lamrim into practice are most rare. But in spite of all this, we were not born in a place with no freedom to practice. According to my own precious gurus, all in tradition, the optimum human rebirth is hard to acquire because it is difficult to achieve, because it is by nature something difficult to create, and because its probability is shown by analogy to be low. This rebirth we have acquired can fulfill our fondest wishes, be they good or evil. We are on the border between the upper and lower realms. We ought not to put our hopes in anything else. The choice lies in our own hands. So we must make no mistake about which choice leads to happiness and which to misery. If we are mistaken, the mistake will not be for a day or two. It will spoil our eternal hopes for all our rebirths. So day 10. So Yajipa Monga quoted the following praise from the time writing of Gyedun Tenzin Gyatso, a great adept. This is not false, invented Dharma, because it is the pith of authentic oral teachings. This is not foolish talk, because it comes from classical texts by the great champions. This is not a shimmering mirage, because saintly scholars and adepts have experienced it. This is not a perilous cliff, because it is the highway to highest enlightenment. He quoted this. So we'll switch to the first paragraph of this, the 10th day teaching. Stopped, and we'll switch to Shamar Lamrim. So how to make this life meaningful? So thinking of achieving, aspiring for higher rebirth, you think that this life will not be forever? So how to make this life meaningful has three paths: training the mind in the path shared with the beings of small scope, and the training the mind in the path shared with the beings of intermediate scope, and training the mind in the path beings with big capacity. The first has two paths: generating the determination to pursue birth in the next world, and showing the methods for well-being in the next life. Of these two, the first has two paths: reflecting on death by acknowledging that one will not live in this world for long, and reflecting on the pains and pleasures of the two types of beings, transmigrations, thinking how the next life would be. Regarding the first, reflecting on the death by acknowledging that one will not live in this world for long, So in order to have this wish for the next rebirth and so forth, we and onwards, we need to use the logic used that is given in Brahmanavartika, that this mind has its continuity. And so because it's produced by causes and conditions, it because it's changing, that it disintegrates moment by moment, that it shows that it has a cause, and therefore that cause has to also to be something which is not static, but that it has its own causes, which also undergoes change. And therefore, inanimate objects cannot be incompatible cause. And so Arthur, during the last Mind and Life conference in held in Drepung, said that, of course, he is not a Buddhist, but he actually is convinced about Buddha, convinced about rebirth. And he said that in the next life also, he prays to be able to serve His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And he usually used to say this to me personally, but he said this in the meeting. And so today, some neuroscientists are doing research on what we call as tukdam, after someone has clinically died, but still the body remains fresh. And so there is such a phenomenon, and therefore we need to do research. And so all the gross states of mind have ceased. And so some scientists have said to me during my last meeting with them, in the 20th century, there are scientists who, the scientists do not recognize a mind, some kind of separate entity from the brain. But towards the towards the end of the 20th century, there are scientists now who say that there is a separate, a different entity or phenomena which is separate from the brain. And from through the experiment, they have found that the brain cells can be impacted by our thought, which is not the brain's. So something is there, they say, that which is not explainable by them, which can impact the brain. And so with regard to consciousness or mind, we can explain it. Of course, these are explained only, the explanations of these are found only in the classical Indian texts and not in Christianity, nor in Islam, nor in Judaism, nor in perhaps Parsi, Zoroastrianism. And then also with regard to Taoism also, they also may not have any explanation about consciousness. They may have this idea of a theistic God. So with regard to the mind, it is only in the Indian tradition where we find really great detailed explanation, and particularly the Nalanda tradition of Buddhism. And so then we need to think. So this subtle mind, so if it is there, then there is no reason why the subtle mind should stop working anymore after the brain cells have stopped working or functioning. So if we have to say that this consciousness is born from the ovum and sperm from parents, then once this person dies in this life, then called the brain itself, if we take the brain as the source of consciousness, then even after brain death, and we could not have any consciousness. So when someone dies, the heartbeat stops, and then after that, then the flow of blood to the brain also stops. And at that point, then once the flow of blood stops, then the brain also stops functioning. And then you have to say that when the brain function stops, the consciousness also stops. So that's not the case. There is still something left in the body. So recently I saw a picture of a Mongolian monk, elderly monk, who was said to have remained in Thugdam, this meditation phenomenon of meditation, for about 25 days. So we cannot explain about about mind on the basis of the brain and the body alone. And so we need to check more, do more research into it. And so for someone who doubts about reincarnation, so they would say that, of course, this when they are told about this, they would say, oh, these are taught in the dharmas, in the religious beliefs. So in Lamrim Chemo, we don't find any explanation of the reason to prove that there is no beginning in the continuity of the mind. So we need to actually supplement this Lamrim Chemo teaching with this kind of logic. So therefore, the structural outline from this point down is not repeated. They're following the single point of this application, think like this. The reason why I and all my mother sentient beings have been undergoing various intense and protracted suffering in this cycle of existence is because of not recalling impermanence and death. For in all our past lives, we had most likely passed only through inopportune realms where we had no time to practice the Dharma. Even when we found some physical life basis suitable for practicing the Dharma, we had been deceived by the thoughts of permanence in this life, thinking, I will not die yet, due to which we only thought about the activities of those current lives, but did not even think of considering future lives. Even when we put effort in the Dharma, we were doing so ostensibly pursuing it, wishing scholarly credibility and fame for the sake of arguing over a few books, or pursue the recitation of some fierce mantras to calm the harmful acts of spirits, evil spirits and ghosts, or to amass a number of empowerments and subsequent permission to practice Tantra with the aim of gathering more disciples, or we covet the title of great meditator and practice the Dharma, confining ourselves to sealed-off caves, since they were aimed only for gains in this life. Whatever virtuous practices we did, they had very little effect. Planning to live a full life till the end of our life, we were obsessed with material gains, honor, and fame in this life, hated those that came in our way, and became ignorant and confused about the shortcomings of those disturbing emotions. When we achieved some good results of our effort, we were full of ourselves, and we constantly experienced strong afflictive emotions such as pure, jealous, competitive feeling, and under the influence of those emotions, we did our best to do sin and cause downfalls of morality, such as creating the then non-virtuous karmas. Consequently, we frequently have been wandering endlessly in the unfortunate realms of existence immediately after dying in these existences. Even now, in this life, the reason why we do not accomplish Dharma, despite all the inner and outer conducive factors, is because of being enslaved by this clinging to permanence in life. Therefore, it is clear to me that taking sides with the thought, I will not die yet, is the gateway to all our troubles and problems. If you bear the correct attitude to death, then you will see that you will soon be separated from everything, your body, wealth, family, friends, which will cause you to feel disillusioned by all three things of this life alone. That is well-being, happiness, fame, and utterly feel disdained with them as if a stack of hay were placed before you. Therefore, you won't do anything which has to do with superficial pleasure of this life, but will engage in as great merit as possible through practice like taking refuge, keeping morality, giving charity, and so on. For the sake of future lives, you will purify all the sins accumulated in the past through the four counteracting forces, so that you will not be confused about attaining a life of freedom and riches, and definitely proceed through the levels of happiness throughout. Hence, being rightly mindful of death is the gateway of all excellent virtues. This is what the Bodhisattva Bodhava seems to have in mind when he said, not being mindful of death, whatever you hear, reflect and meditate on, all of them will be oriented towards your livelihood in this life and not turn into a spiritual practice. But if you become genuinely mindful of death, everything you do will turn into spiritual practice. Therefore, may Guru Deity bless me and everyone else to have the right mindfulness of death in our mind streams. Having prayed thus, think, may I especially, may and the obstacles of the realization of mindfulness of death and I on all such beings develop the special realization of mindfulness. So Kungtan Rinpoche and Jebje Papongka's writings on mindfulness of death reminding us of the mindfulness. These are very good, very beneficial. So we should do that time from time to time. So the actual meditation has three parts: thinking that death is inevitable, thinking that time of death is uncertain, thinking that at time of death nothing but spirituality will help. The first has three subdivisions, and the first of them thinking of that the Lord of death will certainly come and that it cannot be averted by any conditions is. So by visualizing Guru Deity on your crown, reflect like this. This life basis of freedom and riches, which is difficult to find, yet greatly significant, which I have found once, this time will not last long, but will break down. For whatever corporeal life I may be born into, that life cannot escape death. For instance, we find mentioned in sutras few accounts of how the past Buddhas who exceeded even the number of particles of ocean of water appeared on one after the other, ripened and liberated the disciples and finally passed away. And so some archaeological findings in Tibet during the Stone Age, findings of things, artifacts from the Stone Age, which has actually happened in different parts of the world also. And so some Stone Age implements were found in the Amdo region, which were found to be 30,000 years old. And then somewhere in Ngari region, there were some drawings on rocks. So those are said to be 20,000 years. And then in the areas where we find some of the remains of the past kings, were said to be 7,000 years. So we are in this part where the text talks about the three Tibetan Dharma kings, the abbot, the master, the spiritual father, Atisha and his disciple, and the tribe of Marpa, Milarepa, and Thabolhaje, and the five patriarchs of Sakya, and the omniscient king and his disciples, and so on. all of these historical personalities would seem real now if we leave them without analysis. But if we carefully checked, none of them are alive except for their legacies. In other words, until now, there is no one in our hearts, no one in the world who was seen or heard of living without dying after taking birth. If even the Buddhas who have found Vajrabadi and the Arhats who have overcome birth and death do assume passing away, what need to mention that this kind of body of flesh and blood covered with skin will disintegrate. Therefore, while I have no confidence why I should not fear death, yet I do not even question, will I die? No doubt this is because I am deceived by the demon of grasping at impermanence. Wherever I go, there is no place which is immune to death. Hence, death will certainly come to me. For example, when Pagyepo waged a war and killed the Shakyas, the blessed Buddha had concealed some of Shakyas' children within Mount Meru and others in the celestial mansions of the sun and the moon and so forth. But later, when he saw them, all of them had died. So our life is like that. So it is the same with ourselves. In about 80 years from now, of course, none of us may be alive, but children who may at that time reach about 50, 60 or 70 years or 70 or 80 years of age might say, oh, in those days there were such and such people. And then this temple also may not be there after 100 years. So these monastic buildings may be occupied in after 100 years by the Indians, such as the Ladakhi, people from Ladakh or other Himalayan regions. So if you actually disgrace us, then that's up to you. So there are more and more Indians who are following, taking interest in Buddhism in schools and universities, and also in Europe and America, because they find that peace of mind cannot come only through material development, and therefore they search for means for peace of mind and take interest in Buddhism. And the Buddhism, if not the whole of the teaching, but there are people who are taking interest in the Buddhist system. The number of these people are increasing. This is clear. So last time when I visited Japan, the Prime Minister of Mongolia had also come there, and I asked if I come, if it would not be a trouble for him. He said no, and then I went to the hospital. And so I talked about psychology and told him that if you can actually have more knowledge about the psychology that is taught in our Buddhist literature, it would be helpful to have peaceful mind. And so he was actually appreciating these teachings because he is an educated, well-educated person. And so I told we had discussion that the Buddhist teachings will have great impact and influence in the 21st century, in the next centuries as well. And so we are in the 21st century through knowledge and education. It's difficult to through mere faith. And so faith based on blind faith is not going to stay long, but faith which is based on reason and understanding will continue and persist. So all of us will die. Only our names will be left behind. Whether in the past, present or past, present or future, there is no difference. We are all crushed by death. Past is just mentioned. Regarding the So when death comes, if it could be averted through certain conditions, then it may be possible for me to not die. However, it cannot be averted by any condition. However, how? A fast runner cannot run away from it. Even the sages with the fivefold clairvoyance who could travel in the sky cannot run away to a place of deathlessness when death strikes them. It cannot be averted. So the lions, of course, when they become aged, becomes very poor. It's a very sad situation. They cannot actually hunt for food, and there's nobody actually feeding them. And then when at around that time, the lion and lionesses, when they are really old, not able to hunt for food, nor others giving any food, then hyenas also attack them. It's very sad. It cannot be averted by force. A lion may be able to terrify all an animal or cause a scratching on the elephant's scratch on the elephant's head with its claws. So some animals, when they actually attack others, the wild animals actually suffocate their prey by actually stopping their breath, and some actually kill their animals by holding the neck of the prey. So this mention of the elephant's head being scratched by lions cannot be true. So it's not possible because the lion's trunk will actually hit them and slash them on the ground. So the Amdo Lama, not knowing how lions attack elephants, has said this. Yet when death comes, it loses its power and must pass away from life. Though a Chakravartin king may have immense power, wealth, and countless wise expert ministers, but when his lifespan ends, he cannot elude death. He must go, leaving his kingdom behind. If we look at Taj Mahal, the king who built the king Taj Mahal, or the builders of the Chinese kings building the Chinese wall, the wall of the Great Wall of China, and so forth. Of course, they have actually used so many people. It had not created any kind of merit. But they have actually caused so much misery to people, the laborers, thinking actually that they would live for long. And so we also do that in our life. So thinking that we will live, we do all kinds of things. And so mantra and medicines cannot avert it. It's said that when the time comes, comes, death cannot be overcome, even by the medicine given by the doctor and or the protection given by Vajrapani. Thus, as it is natural that birth has its end in death, nobody can escape it. Whereas, if I had done a sincere, pure act of virtue, I would not have to fear death when it befalls me. Yet, leave alone the lasting goal. So far, I don't even recall having done an impeccable, virtuous deed that would become the root cause of fortunate. Sorry. Fortunate rebirth. And so when we die, what goes is the subtle mind and not the gross state of mind. So on the basis of this continuum, the mind stream, we, of course, this is the basis for the imprints of our karma. According to Chitta Matra, they use the term alaya vijana, they assert the alaya vijnana is that basis for the karmic imprints. And then those who assert that a person, a human being, the final identity of human beings is the sixth consciousness, also say that this sixth consciousness is the basis for which carries the imprint. But the subtle mind is the temporary basis for imprint of the karma and imprints, whereas the mere designated I is the enduring basis for the imprints. And then we also need to think about the having seized this phenomenon called having seized phenomenon of four, this carrying the imprint. If I were to die this very moment, I would certainly be impelled into an unfortunate rebirth. Hence, I will anyway do some religious practice that would help me when I breathe my last and my body becomes a corpse, whereby my consciousness follows another karma and passes through a horrible narrow path. And so when I was young, there was an aristocrat who used to boast and showing off. And on a temple, a stupa, there is written Sharzongkapala Namo, Sharzongkapala Namo, and he read in such a way that Sharzongkapa Lobsan Thakpa. So he actually broke the name Lobsan Thakpa into Lo and Zangdakpa as separate. And so said that Sharzongkapa Lo, and then said Zangdakpa Lanamo. So he read it completely wrongly. So in my childhood, there was a Chertingpa who was a guard at my residence. And he told me once that in his village, maybe there were people who didn't know, who were illiterate. And then one of the elderly person actually pretended that he knew, he was literate. He pretended to be literate, and he pretended to be making notes of the minutes of their meeting. And then the next time these people met again, and some of them actually told this person that last time when we met, you wrote some notes, you made some notes. And so this person replied by saying that, how can I actually read something that I wrote last year? So actually, he wasn't literate, but he pretended in front of the others. And so this is a story I heard in my childhood. So pray, may. And so Buddhism is something very like poking its nose into different things. And so if you do something good in the earlier part of your life, we can see the fruits of that in the later part of your life. So how come that our karma that we created in this life has impact in the next life? And then we come to the explanation of the imprint of the karma. And so there is lots of investigation done. And then in the Shatamatra view, the Alaya Vijnana is proved, or they use many different reasons to prove Alaya Vijnana. And so Buddhism is actually a system where you find truth through, I mean, facts, truth based on facts. So we also need to inquire about the modern subjects, science and so forth. And so we can say that because we use lots of reasoning, investigation, and experiments, we can say that it is something we can actually put to the test of reasoning. So pray, may Guru Deity bless me to be able to do so and do your meditation. Life has no additional scopes but factors that constantly diminish by my lifespan. Most of my life is gone and I do not know how much of it still remains. Even if I live the longest lifespan today, that is 70 or 80, which is regarded living a full lifespan, it finishes quickly. With breath, 21,000 times during a full cycle of a day, but after one breath, we breathe 21,000 times during a full cycle of a day, but after one breath, we come down to 21,599. Reflecting on it, we cannot actually revert to the previous moment. It's gone. And so, reflecting on it, as our lifespan shortens with each breath, there is no moment our lifespan does not deplete at all. Likewise, when 30 days are finished, with each passing day, a month goes by, a year passes by, when 12 months have gone, with each passing month, and with each passing year, when 5 or 6 12-year cycles are completed, our lifespan has exhausted and we reach the time of death. But for us, our body has the capacity to live for 100 years. But because of pollution and also pesticides and so forth, we have lots of so many different illnesses today. But for the lifespan propelled by our past karma, there is no additional lifespan added at all. Hence, death is certain and nothing else. This seems comparable to the certain exhaustion of a pool of water when its bottom leaks, and when we cut the source of its water upstream. And the more time it takes one to overcome enemies while looking after the relations to and accumulate food and wealth, the closer the agent of these actions approaches death. When building a house, the longer it takes to finish it, the honor moves to death without a respite. Thus, the owner, though, will have not much time to enjoy the house. Not knowing it, he or she concedes accomplishing a great purpose. This is indeed very foolish. Likewise, whatever work we do or are doing, such as eating, drinking, moving, resting, sleeping, sitting, and so on, as our lifespan ebbs out, there is not a moment when we are not approaching death. It is mentioned that since our conception in the mother's womb, we have not rested even for a moment, but moved on towards the next world, as if galloping away. This is true indeed. If we reflect on it, and the seventh Dalai Lama Gyatso Kyatso has said, from birth, we are helpless, unable to remain still even for a moment. We gallop towards Yamaraja, Lord of Death. Though living, we journey on the highway of death. How sad this situation, akin to a criminal being led to an execution place. Furthermore, a person obsessed with the taste of fruit on a tree on the face of a cliff of a big waterfall presses his feet against a tuft of grass at a cliff and grabs a tuft of grass with one hand while reaching out to the fruit with the other hand. At that time, two rats, one white and the black, comes by and they alternate nipping at the nipping and taking away the blade of grass at a time. However, he neglected them and the tufts became thinner and thinner, and finally, as the grass exhausted, he fell off the cliff and suffers immensely. Had he put effort before the tufts of grass were gone, he could have led himself to a safe heaven. Instead, he did not attempt to save himself, but threw himself down the precipice. What more foolish person could there be to do so? Likewise, while we are residing at the cliff of samsara, by relying on the tuft of life, and as the rats of day and night deplete the tuft of life, if we do not bother about it, but indulge in this apparent tasty fruit of the five sense objects and distracted by them, and be distracted by them, then when the tuft of life ends, we fall down the cliff of lower to lower realms of existence, and will be swept away by the rivers of suffering. It is high time that before the end of life, we should do our best to put effort to accomplish the path in order to pass through the higher rebirth successively and reach the city of omniscience. Though we know we have ability to do that, yet how could we really jump off the cliff of hell unconsciously? Right now, so even if we may live, the longest lifespan we could live in this degenerate time, we should not still be carried away by the thought that we will not die but live. You must not procrastinate thinking that you have time to practice the Dharma. This is because when you were a child, you had no idea about Dharma, but only thought about play and fun, whereby 15 years went by. After that, you have been making your livelihood and looking after your near and dear ones, for those for whose sake you have done business, religious rituals for the villagers, begging, flattering the rich, and so the lay people also, when they were young, did not think about doing any Dharma practice, and then you went through education. And then, after finishing your education, you thought about finding some job, and then marrying, and then having children. And if you have no children, if you can't give birth to children, you have suffering. If you have too many children, you have suffering. And then rearing the children, and also sending them to school and getting education for them, you have suffering. You have all kinds of worries, all these worries about your children going through the education, and then after education, they're getting a job for them, and so forth. And so when you think along this line about this situation of the lay people, then you can see the advantage of the monastics. So it is true what the Buddha has said, that householder's life has so much ills. So the householder's life, the different things, the works and so forth that they do, are like the ripples on the ripples that form on the water, surface of water. One leads to the next. And so, wouldn't it be better to cut all these forcibly, Gongdang Tenpo Dharma says. As Pabongkapa says, if you are able to practice, there is liberation, even as you live as a householder's life. But if you cannot practice, then you would not have nirvana, but you maybe cause for suffering, even if you live as a hermit. And so the Buddha shown us the path to liberation by living a monastic life. And also the Buddha himself went through the austere practices, in the 6-year practice of austerity, which shows example to us that in order to reach the goal of enlightenment, we need to work hard. And so the Buddha himself, of course, the Shakyamuni Buddha was someone who attained the four Buddha bodies. If we do not accept that, there would be, again, lots of logical inconsistencies. to say that the Buddha was an ordinary person in that life as Shakyamuni. So he has shown us the path through his own practice of the six-year austere practice that we need to actually endure hardships in order to train on the path and reach our goal. And then after that, those six-year practice of austerity, he actually showed us how he became enlightened under the Bodhi tree. So we have the example in the Buddha himself. So thinking along these things, it would be easy to know that there is only a little time to practice the Dharma. So the text says, from the remaining lifespan, you spend half of it in sleep, as usual. You are also compelled to do many things which are no use to oneself and others. When you are stricken by suffering at old age, you will lose your physical stamina and would be weak to practice the Dharma. So thinking along these things, think about these things, it would be easy to know that there is only a little time to practice the Dharma. On a New Year day, for instance, we would talk about celebrating in great joy and happiness, and our day would quickly pass without time for Dharma. The second day and the third day of the New Year would also be the same. Once the prayer festival of the miracle month starts, we would be unaware how the month went by as we indulge ourselves in the hectic life. In this way, as remaining months pass, the year would go by without any opportunity for Dharma practice. Then the second year would go by, and gradually or eventually your whole life would go by empty. And so if you have to go to the next life without having the time to practice Dharma, that would certainly be a big loss. Even when we set our time, When we set some time to sit in a secluded retreat, ostensibly doing some virtuous practice, what number of nights there are, they pass in sleep. The days are lost in preparing our food and drinks and slowly enjoying them at breakfast, lunch, tea break, lunch, and afternoon tea. We lose time in irrelevant idle gossip and planning and carrying out our mundane activities. Also, during the actual practice sessions, apart from continuing the number of mantras, our mind is all over the country with the undercurrent of inappropriate thoughts and conceptions, and this is clear to oneself. Therefore, those sincerely practicing the Dharma then are next to impossible. If this is the case, it goes without saying that after we come out of the retreat, we would not have time to practice the Dharma when we meet and when we rest and relax. Everyone thinks, when I'm done with all the important works, then I will practice the Dharma. But unless you have softened your attachment to this life and more your accomplishment, more you accomplish your worldly activity, the more it increases. But it is impossible to finish it. We do many things for the sake of such things as comfort, joy, fame in this life. But these good things are only accomplished according to whatever karma has impelled us to achieve them. And they would be difficult to come by merely through our efforts. Suppose we fulfill a little excellent result due to ripening of some positive karma, it would not be additional in additional misery at the time of death. But there will be not the slightest benefit. It would be similar to a dream in which you saw pleasure for a moment, but when you woke up, there is nothing. However, death will certainly come, and therefore we must forcibly give up all the distraction to this life and engage in sincere practice of the Dharma by praying. May I be able to do so? Thank and on the crown of my crown, in order to generate an extraordinary conviction and realizing the certainty of death, an extraordinary certainty, and so forth. Second, reflecting when death will happen is uncertain, has three parts, of which reflecting on the uncertainty of lifespan on the earth is being. If you think, of course, I finally must die when I reach the end of old age. But right now I'm young, have no illness, have all the favorable conditions, and no harm from my enemies. Therefore, I will not die for some time. These are no guarantees at all, because of the different ways of creating their karmas. We can see with our direct perception that some sentient beings die inside mother's womb, some immediately after birth, others as they start crawling, and still others when they are able to run. Some die in youth, others in middle age, and so on. It is next to impossible that people die living with a full, matured lifespan. Some boisterous young men in flashy costumes during the morning die suddenly in the afternoon, and their bodies are taken to the cremation ground. Many times it is witnessed that the frail old parents have to perform the funeral rites for their children and grandchildren. Hence, how can mere youth be the reason for your not dying? Many healthy, dignified people pass from life before some people who are chronically sick for years and are on the verge of death. Many rich people also. So sometimes I have medical checkup with doctors, and I met one German doctor who is said to be an expert on knee, and he was really genuine and dedicated when he checked me. So he said to me, I'm no more 18, but 80 years, and therefore some cartilage or some kind of lubrication, much of it that has now worn out, he said. And so I cannot complain about. So when he said that, I found that to be a great instruction to me. So many rich people with all the necessities, die before old beggars wandering in hunger. So one should actually think that it is possible to to do Dharma practice, and during the fifth Dalai Lama's times, when some lamas and officials come by, then the others have to stand up. And so the fifth Dalai Lama says that sometimes he pretended as if he had some problem in his knees and didn't used to just keep sitting. So, of course, I'm not pretending to have a bad knee, but I actually have a bad knee, and therefore sometimes I don't get up from my seat during certain rituals. And so one should find think that it is worthwhile for me, it is right for me to do Dharma practice before I lose this life. So sometimes some practitioners externally may appear to be practitioners, but actually they are so greedy to get some things when people die. So I've seen people coming to some people who were serving me, saying that they were relatives, and actually they must be. I think they were coming to if they could get something, some remains or something that is that belongs to the that person. And so some nomads have lots of cattle and also sheep and horses. During their childhood, they see these things, so the author must be familiar with these kind of nomads. And so the cattle and sheep and so forth are killed by wolves, and then and so when the animals when the people keep animals, they are said to kill them for meat. And so it's quite too much to say that, you know, when we eat meat, that, oh, this meat is just lean or it has no grease and fat and so forth, that it is hard, difficult to, you know, bite and so forth. This is too much. And so I had a Polish friend, an elderly lady, and a very old woman and a very old man. They were not, of course, couples. So both of them didn't take meat. And so we were very close friends. And so he told that this man told me that I don't take meat. If I take meat, I'll kill the animal myself. But what we do is let others kill, and behind the scenes sort of thing, we eat the meat. So, of course, if the meat is free of the three faults, then perhaps it may be a different case. But in the past, when monks gave tongo offering to the monastic community, it was said that a few of the bulls or buffaloes were killed. During Drukpa Khunle's time or something, he was said to have actually made fun of the places of butcher slaughterhouses near Serra and Dambak regions in central Tibet. So when we eat the meat and use the skin, we don't think that this was once part of an animal who actually held its own body to be very dear to him itself. And we kind of enjoy it so much, saying this is tasty and it's greasy and so forth. So these are talking about real things here. And then we use the different instruments of Tantra, such as the bone trumpet and dramaru and so forth. So in the and in the Bodhisattva Charya Avatara, it is said that so by going to the funeral place, just meditate that looking at the other's body, those bones were like meditate that as if they are yours, and how horrible it is. And you, in this way, meditating on the other's body as being your body, you'll be able to actually neutralize your attachment to the body. And so you may be from some place, and after 6 or 7 years being away from your place, when you return, you may find that everyone there was so new to you that nobody who were known to you were there anymore. And so when you see this, of course, it is like a lesson for reminding you of the impermanence of death and death. And so all these pleasures of life, this life, are like should be seen as a dream experience, which is transient. And so even if we are able to, about to die, when we see somebody is about to die, or that somebody is stricken with some kind of sickness, which will lead to a fatal kind of sickness, we never think that, we never actually come to think that, oh, I will also have the same kind, go through the same kind of situation of death. And so recently I met one Hindu Swami, and he introduced himself to me and said that he was actually helping people suffering from lepers, and he actually cleans the feet and hands of these lepers. Sometimes animals and others are actually killed by spirits and so forth. And then natural disasters also kill animals and so forth. Today we actually experience global warming. So over 100 years period of time, things have changed, and therefore there is this global warming. And today, when we have very strong storms and rains, and then the glaciers, the rate of melting of the glaciers is also increasing, and then the water level also rises, and it is said that many of the big cities are going to be underwater. And so there is natural disasters like this, and today we have 7 billion people on this earth, and towards the end of this century, it is said that we will have 10 billion. And so there are lots of problems and troubles. And even while we have lots of problems like this, still people engage in wars and fightings and conflicts. We don't think about next lives. If just in this life, if we could be more friendly, harmonious, and helping each other, it would be possible for us to create a more peaceful world. If we as humans could live a more peaceful and happier life, then it would also be helpful and to the animal realm as well. And so if the heat is, if there is too much heat, we have a problem. If there is too much coldness, we have suffering again. So it is, this body is like, having this body is like living in amongst a group of snakes, the poisonous snakes, which live always kind of fight with each other. So within this body, we have these different elements which are opposite to each other, opposing each other, like fire and heat and cold and water and so forth. So as it is said in the 400 verses, this is true. So if we have too much heat in the body, we suffer fever. And then in this way, we suffer all kinds of sicknesses. So we still have our karma, and because of which, even if we become sick or suffer so much, we still live. So we are at a degenerate time where we have all the five degenerations. So this body becomes very feeble, and it becomes very difficult to prolong our lifetime as well. And therefore, we will die. So if you were trapped in a house which is on fire, so today there are lots of motor accidents, and because of which many people die. So many of the conditions which are meant for us to live actually becomes cause of death. And lay people, due to too much alcohol, drinking too much alcohol, you ruin your liver, and then you suffer other sicknesses, diseases. And so many of the causes or conditions for living are turned into the conditions for death. So people who are equal to oneself, monks and nuns, monks and lay people, monastics and lay people, so become poor due to their age, and they become weak and suffer. And so many of us think that, oh, if I do not do something now, we'll suffer in old age, and therefore indulge in all kinds of activities, such as flattering to other with others, and gaining wealth, and so forth. And we do not actually think that we will suffer in the future. Do not have any doubt about, do not question about future suffering. But when we will die is uncertain. So there's no doubt that death will befall us. This is for sure. But even if we have to suffer at old age, that is going to be a very short-lived. But without being able to do a practice of the Dharma, one will not be able to fathom the suffering in the next lives. And then the next topic is nothing but the Dharma can help you at the time of death. So even a sip of water or liquid and a mouthful of food, you would not be able to enjoy them. And today we have people suffering from throat cancer or some stomach cancer and so forth, so that they are not able to ingest their food from the mouth, but there some hole has to be made so that they can be fed through some pipe. So when you die, you cannot take anybody with you whom you may call your servants or and so forth. As the Dalai Lama, I too cannot take anybody with me, my disciples or bodyguards and security people and so forth. So you have to go alone to the next life, and your body remains behind as a corpse. And all the relatives and so forth, for their sake, you have created lots of negative karmas, sins, which you have to actually carry with you. Nobody will carry them for yourself. And then, whatever you have remained, your wealth and money and so forth, are actually coveted by those who are left behind. The people become greedy for your wealth. So your body will be taken to cremation grounds or buried under the ground, or it will be taken to some cremation funeral ground where the body will be left for the vultures to eat. So people are not actually reflecting on where their consciousness will go after dying, but they are so worried and sad, they express their sorrow over someone's dead body. So the greater you have left, the greater imprint you have left of virtue in your mind stream, you will be helped more by this. So of course, you will not be able to use the subtle mind, the clear light mind, without being able to dissolve the gross state of mind. And so, the more you create the mental virtues of the three, body, speech, and mind, and that will be really able to help you. These negative emotions, we hear that no sooner they arise in you, they disturb your peace of mind. While you are able to recognize that negative emotions is such a state of mind, if we could not start your practice to actually reduce these then if we could, if we are not able to do that, then we will not be able to help ourselves at the time of death. But if we are able to help ourselves to see the negative emotions as negative emotion, and that they destroy our peace of mind, and do something to reduce it, and then practice the virtuous, do the virtuous practices, so that when the at this gross level of mind, we are able to do that, so that it leaves an imprint at the deeper level of mind, then it can help. For example, we see children, even as young, at young age, doing. Some children are indulge in negative actions, some in positive actions, which indicate something. So I have some Indian friends who have told me that their child, this very small child they have, would rise up in the middle of the night and act like as if he is doing some meditation. There are such children as well. So whatever effort you actually put in gaining wealth, resources, food, and so forth, will not help you at all. And so you should leave all this aside, putting an effort in this kind of thing, trivial things aside, and focus on meditation, doing Dharma practice. So just as it is taught in the sutra given to a king, so of course we need to think about the uncertainty of the time of death. And we also have tomorrow, teaching tomorrow, but before we eat, we would be causing ourselves more suffering, or if we don't take food, thinking that, the time of death is uncertain. Metatam re rabling shing ye de kemba de
sanye ye do bele boye no 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 no